In his new book, The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century, Steven Pinker, the New York Times bestselling author, linguist, cognitive scientist, and chair of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary, rethinks the usage guide for the 21st century and applies insights from the sciences of language and mind to the challenge of crafting clear, coherent, and stylish prose. Steven Pinker is the Johnstone Family Professor of Psychology at Harvard University, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Very nice to have you here. What brought you to this idea of wanting to look at, certainly you've written much on language, but to bring us to the idea of style?
Well, I've spent a good chunk of my life trying to explain complicated ideas to a wide audience, and those complicated ideas are about language itself. So what better crossover possibilities than to take what I know about how language works and use it to help people use language more effectively?
Why do you think that good writing is often difficult and has been difficult for people?
It's always been difficult. And people who complain about the decline of the language are, I think, fail to appreciate that there's always been a lot of bad writing, and people made the same complaints 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago. It's difficult in part because we are somewhat wired for speech, but we're certainly not wired for writing. Writing is highly unnatural. You don't have another person sitting there nodding and furrowing his brow and breaking in if you're unclear. You've got to anticipate what a generic reader does or doesn't know. And human beings are very bad at that. We don't have mental telepathy. Also, I think people underestimate the difficulty of writing. A lot of people just plonk their thoughts down on paper and think that that's writing. Whereas, in fact, the order in which thoughts occur to you is rarely the same as the order in which they're easily grasped by a reader. And so you really have to take another pass and radically rearrange all the words in the sentences so they form a nice, coherent story. You can't just blurt out what's on your mind and expect it to cohere.
How important are the rules we were all taught, or at least should have been taught?
Well, there are rules we don't even think about. Like, we put the verb before the object. We say, he ate the bagel, not the bagel ate. And that means we speak English and not German. If we grew up speaking German, we would know different rules. And these are rules that don't have to be taught. We just pick them up as kids, and we never give them a moment's thought. There are some more persnickety rules that apply to the written form of the language. And that if you went to school before the 1960s, you may have been taught don't begin a sentence with and, don't end a sentence with a preposition, don't split an infinitive, don't let a participle dangle. And I have a big chunk of the book where I talk about these rules, many of which, by the way, are totally bogus. No one knows exactly where they came from. They don't apply to the best practices of English writers over the centuries. A lot of them violate the logic of the English language. And so there's certain rules that you can blow off because they just should never have been in the rule books in the first place. But there are also some distinctions that a careful writer should make. And in the book, I try to give people advice on how to tell the difference. Which are the bogus rules? Which are the ones worth paying attention to?
Should we know how to diagram a sentence?
Yes, this is a lost art. And I kind of bring it back. I don't use the system of little railway tracks that kids were taught prior to the 1960s, because I don't think it's a particularly good system. But just being able to think about grammar is, first of all, it's just enjoyable because if you have any kind of systematic mind, if you like popular science, if you like just logic, there is a beauty to the way words fit together into phrases and sentences. And also, if someone corrects your writing and you want to know what they're talking about, it really helps to know a few things like what's a subordinate clause, what's a predicate, what's a modifier, what's the difference between an adjective on the one hand and a modifier on another. And it's useful not only in profiting from the advice of other people. So you just as you can't take advice on cooking or baseball or photography unless you know a little bit of lingo. Knowing a little bit of lingo about our language itself is bound to help us communicate about it better. And it's useful in other fields like literary criticism, poetry, logic, linguistics, computer science. All of these use concepts from grammar. And if it's taught in a spirit of exploration rather than kind of dogmatic, do this, don't do that, then I like to think it's a kind of an enjoyable thing to read about, just like people read about, you know, dinosaurs or medicine or the ecology.
I love the word style because it does bring about this idea of the artistic landscape of language and how writers, especially fiction writers and poets, are able to use that language in such an effective way. Is it the beauty of the language? Does that trump what is quote unquote correct or incorrect?
Oh, often it does, and all of the great English stylists flouted many of the so-called rules, showing that the rules were just superstitions, and they really are. If it doesn't apply to the practices of the best writers, then it's really not a part of the English language. And it's also true that it's not just in poetry and literary fiction that the beauty of words and the rhythm of phrases matters. In the first chapter of the book, I go over a number of passages of ordinary prose, science books, obituaries, memoirs, and show that there's a lot of poetry in prose nonfiction as well. A sentence with a nice strong meter, a sentence that occasionally uses alliteration, that is repeating a consonant, like a plethora of pain, can also often be effective, even if you're not explicitly trying to be poetic.
You were talking a moment ago about people who will often assail the language and the usage, and there are certainly those people out there who are the grammar police, and this is of great concern. The easiest radio show to ever do is to open up the phone lines and say, "What are your language pet peeves?"
Yes, that switchboard's light up.
Just right up. I mean, 80 calls in 2 seconds. So what
right.
What is it about the subject, do you think, that gets people so to their core?
Yes. A cynical view is that some of it is just one-upmanship. You can be a smarty-pants and you can correct other people for errors that you allege that they make. But there also is a feeling of... That the ground is shaking under you, and that the fabric of civilization is unraveling. If the tacit conventions that we all follow to communicate are being flouted, and there's I cite a number of examples of completely ludicrously extreme reactions to grammatical errors. That once the string is untuned, the oceans will rise up over the shores and make a sop of this solid globe. Today people treat language the way the Nazis treated the inmates of concentration camps. I mean, completely over the top, tasteless hyperbole, and it shows that there really are strong reactions to rules of usage, which is ironic because even though I think that people should know some rules that are worth following, it's probably the least important ingredient in good style. You can follow every rule in the book and still write wretchedly, and there are clear writers who flout even the rules that I would say you shouldn't flout. Far more important than worrying about fused participles and split infinitives are basics like coherence. That is, does one sentence imply the next in a way that the reader can figure out? Clarity and concreteness and vividness. Are you writing in turgid abstractions, or are you allowing the reader to form good, clear mental images as you go along? And to say nothing of, is what you're saying true? Did you bother to look it up, or are you just pulling claims out of the air? Are your arguments logical? Now, many things go into good writing, but I have the final chapter on rules of correct and incorrect usage because I think, while worth paying attention to, it's low on the list.
You do make the point in the book that this language purism often affects our ability to write well.
Oh, yes, there are. In fact, often if you try to follow these rules, your prose will be much worse. And my favorite example was when Barack Obama was inaugurated to his first term of the presidency in 2009, and Chief Justice John Roberts, who was a famous stickler for grammar, unilaterally amended the Constitution and changed the order of the words in the oath of office because he thought it had a an ungrammatical split verb in it. So instead of instructing Obama to say, I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States, he said, I will execute the office of President of the United States faithfully. So he unsplit the split verb, which, by the way, is a completely phony rule. There is actually no such prohibition in English, despite what a lot of sticklers think. And in doing so, he actually made the sentence clumsier and, of course, cast doubt on the legitimacy of the transition of power. And so he had to repeat the oath of office, split verb and all, in private chambers later that afternoon, just so that the birthers wouldn't go crazy and claim that he wasn't really president.
The other point that you make, and I think it's such a great point, is that it is so important to understand, to acknowledge, and here's the key word, to accept that language changes over time.
Yes, and that's another thing that people often don't realize, even though it is the most solid law of language there is, probably. No language has ever stop changing. It's just an impossibility. It's like shoveling against the tide. Now, that doesn't mean that everything changes, and a lot of the usage controversies that concern words that where people are terrified that fine semantic distinctions will be lost forever. It turns out that they both the good sense and the bad sense persist for decades, sometimes centuries. So, for example, purists will say that disinterested should not be used to mean bored or uninterested. It should be used to mean impartial, unbiased, without a vested interest in. And that if people misuse it to mean bored, then we'll have lost a lovely distinction in the language. Well, it turns out they've been making that complaint for something like 150 years. And here we are in the 21st century, and you still see disinterested used in the preferred sense. So some things do change. Purists were upset when the verb to contact entered the language in the 1930s. Now it's hard to find anyone who even realizes that it was once controversial. Many of the so-called errors pass into the language. And then many of the things that people worry will disappear don't disappear.
Well, the name of the book is The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. The book is published by Viking. Steven Pinker, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century, published by Viking. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.